From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made with the nuns. We're talking about religion this hour, but we're not talking about the kind of nuns you might assume we're referencing. Instead, what I mean is the word nun, as in N-O-N-E, no religious affiliation. Earlier this year, Scientific American published a piece about the rise of the so-called nuns. They cited data showing a slow but steady increase in Americans who self-identify as secular or non-religious or agnostic or atheist. Here's the data. Back in 2007, 16% of Americans said they were not religious in any way. 16%. In 2013, that number had increased to 23%. And now, the newest Pew polling. It's still 23% of Americans who self-identify as non-religious, but the striking number comes from all Americans born after 1980, the so-called millennials and Gen Z. 36% of that population describes itself as non-religious. Scientific American concludes that the age of the nuns is coming. In raw numbers, 56 million Americans are not religious. But it's also fair to say that America remains a largely Christian nation. 71% of Americans self-identify as Christians. More than a third of that population is evangelical. And here's where things get a little strange. Pew did research to find out how much Americans know about Christianity. Turns out that out of 12 questions, atheists and agnostics score better than Christians do about Christianity. Well, it's the day after Christmas, and let's start the hour with warm Christmas greetings for all of our listeners who celebrate. Merry Christmas. My guest this hour is someone who is one of the most educated people in our community regarding Christianity. He teaches Hebrew Bible interpretation at Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School, and his resume is a long and impressive one. Born in England, Mark Brummett was not brought up by particularly religious parents. He discovered church and the concept of God largely on his own, and he began studying and studying and studying. I do not have time to list all of his impressive degrees and awards. Mark Brummett has written for numerous publications. He's given countless public lectures, and he teaches classes that include everything from connecting religious history to modern warfare, to the biblical parallels, to Frankenstein. In short, I promise, he is one of the most interesting people to come on Connections in a long time. Professor Mark Brummett, welcome to Connections.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's the day after Christmas, and it's a time where a lot of people are thinking about a number of things related to the work that you do throughout much of the year and throughout many of the years. So I'm going to start you with a strange question. Are you ready?
Okie dokie.
Okay. What percentage confidence do you have that Jesus of Nazareth was a real person?
I'm pretty sure.
Not like, was he Son of God?
No,
was he divine?
I hear exactly what you're asking.
Okay, yeah.
And I think on those terms, I think it's pretty secure he was a historical figure.
High 90s percentage, you feel?
Yeah. I mean, and also this is not my primary area of scholarship. However, I do keep up with some of the currents, and I did read Bart Ehrman's recent book on the topic, and I think he, who is not strongly faith committed to the Son of God aspect of Jesus, nevertheless is quite happy to say there's pretty substantial evidence to say that Jesus is not a mythic figure, but was a historical figure, whatever the overlay that then is added.
And there's a reason I'm asking this, not just to be provocative. I ask because you have written a lot and taught a lot on Jeremiah,
mm-hmm.
who came many, six centuries before Jesus?
Is yes.
That? Okay. So we'll get to Jeremiah in a moment. The reason I ask about your confidence in the strength of the percentage that Jesus was a historical figure, the whole question of epistemology is fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to recommend a recent conversation that Chris Hayes on his podcast had with David Roberts, who often writes about climate, but also studied philosophy and epistemology and writes a lot about that. Why do we form the beliefs we do? Where do we trust knowledge? That podcast, by the way, taught me that I know nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because none of us are actually verifying anything that we're... The knowledge that we gain, very few pieces of knowledge we ever acquire, do we verify?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Very.
Does that worry you?
No. I think I would be classed among my appears as quite postmodern. And it's just to hold back that any claim we make is always going to be somewhat provisional. And I think that's fine.
You're comfortable with that.
I am.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, listening to Roberts and Hayes, you know, they were pointing out that knowledge acquisition doesn't come from verification. It comes from trust of authority. And we are beholden to our parents and those who rear us. And then we are beholden to educational structures. And then we are beholden to sort of political choices we make. So a lot of our knowledge acquisition as adults comes from trusting whatever political party or tribe or group we describe ourselves in. And
I think
there's a lot of questioning.
I think that's fair. And hence, every new generation will tweak it a little or confront to various extents what has been received. And so the former generation wonders what on earth, they're throwing it all away, they're destroying everything that I hold precious. And a new generation is having to rethink and reestablish. So the tradition continues, but is always tweaked a little or turned a little, and sometimes more radically than others.
Yeah, it's not to say that we don't actually know anything. It just means we're not really verifying. And the reason I'm bringing it up in this context is there has been interesting debates in recent years. You referenced Bart Ehrman's work, conceding the point that Jesus was a historical figure, but also trying to show through scholarship that it is very difficult to substantiate some of the claims about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And again, not even the miracle claims, just the day-to-day life claims. Where did he travel? Who was he with? Who followed him? That's very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And your work is very far and wide, so I don't mean to compartmentalize it so much. But Jeremiah was 6 centuries before Jesus.
Yes.
What's your confidence level that Jeremiah was a historical figure?
Much lower. Much lower. And it's interesting that the rise of an interest in the historical Jesus, which was very much a late 19th century movement, arrived hand in hand and progressed hand in hand with an interest in the historical Jeremiah. And the historical Jesus has been more successful.
He is more recent.
There is a breadth of documentation which just isn't there for Jeremiah. And it's been a major crisis in biblical scholarship, even more broadly than just scholars of the book of Jeremiah. In fact, there was a book published late 90s, probably, called The Collapse of History, which described something that was going on in biblical scholarship worldwide during the 90s, basically, in which many things which were thought to be historical facts were looking a bit less secure. And one of those was the figure of Jeremiah. And a lot of the questions about the historicity of the portrait and biography of Jeremiah came from an Irish scholar working in Glasgow University in the 80s and 90s, whose name was Robert Carroll. And he rigorously applied historical method to the biography and said that a lot of the claims would not pass muster in a purely historical search and department. The stories of Jeremiah in the book of Jeremiah, and no other stories of Jeremiah exist outside that book unless they are developments from that book, rewrites or extensions of that book. None of them exist outside the book of Jeremiah, so we only have the book of Jeremiah, and the way the stories are written are largely to make a theological point, so are kind of what we might call hagiographies, or rather theatricalized representations. That doesn't mean to say there was never historical Jeremiah per se. It's simply to say that what we have in the book is a development of whatever germ began the book.
Okay, well then, as a postmodernist, does it matter if Jeremiah was a historical figure?
I like my job.
Oh no! You think it's just dawning on you. You've come on Connections, and you think that I'm questioning the entire basis of your work.
No.
That's not true.
No, I like my job, so I need to say that it doesn't matter because I haven't thrown the book in the trash, and it doesn't matter because, somewhat contradictorily, the book is fascinated with historical events, but it rather dramatizes them for subsequent generations. One of Robert Carroll's, the scholar I mentioned earlier, one of his analogies is to compare Shakespeare's Henry V with what we know of an historical Henry V and show that what Shakespeare is doing is riffing on history for an Elizabethan, two centuries later, mm-hmm. audience. And Jeremiah becomes rather a symbolic figure of survival through the Babylonian exile.
The fall of Jerusalem?
Yes.
587 BC.
Precisely.
Okay, and so what you're saying is maybe Jeremiah existed.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you make that face at me? I studied. Very, very surface level.
I was very impressed.
Okay, yeah.
People don't, even if they study, it's not a date they carry in their head necessarily.
You can learn so much from Wikipedia. I should have just taken the compliment. But what you're saying is maybe Jeremiah was a historical figure, maybe not, but even if he was probably much more of this mundane person, and the representation still tells us things. I mean, it matters. It still matters. It's just the historicity of it matters less in this particular case.
Yeah, it's very much a collection of poems and sermons and portraits dealing with an historical event and reflecting on that event, not written with the kind of modern desire to verify historical facts that is our obsession. It's much more a what do we learn from events of our past. And we even do see that in the gospel representations of Jesus. One of the earliest statements about gospel writing talks, if I'm remembering rightly, and any New Testament scholars listening to this right now might stand up and shake their fists at the speaker. But one of the earliest statements about gospel writing was to say that Mark's gospel, I believe it was based on the sermons of Peter and the sayings of the apostle Peter. And so already we have this sense that Peter is telling the stories of Jesus to educate beyond just talk about who Jesus was historically, but what he represents, who he is theologically.
I want to just say to listeners who are 10 minutes in going, boy, you made a lot of promises with your introduction, Evan. You're talking about the rise of secularism, the rise of the so-called nuns. You have this fascinating professor, and you're already in the esoteric weeds of whether Jeremiah was a historical figure or not. I promise there's a reason.
There's a path here.
There's a long road, and we're going to have like a Saul Paul revelation on this road to where we're going with this. I promise.
Okay.
But I feel like it would matter more if we had some sort of evidence that actually Saul or Paul was not a real person than someone like Jeremiah, for a number of different reasons. And I think the modern nuns, the rise of secularism in America is for a number of reasons. But I feel like when I talk to Gen Zers and millennials, I would think, and this is a guess and you can help me see if this is right or wrong here, that there's been more of an interest in verification. This question of, well, what do we really know about Jesus? And that's one of the things that Ehrman likes to sort of explore. Well, would he have been buried in a mass grave given the mm-hmm. customs of the time? Or would he have been given his own burial place? Could we have known that if his mm-hmm. body was gone? Would it have been stolen or robbed? And I feel like these questions matter more to like modern Americans and secularists than they have for centuries to people who are more interested in the tradition and the ideas. And I wonder if that irks you or if you have any thoughts about that.
It doesn't irk me. I just find it an interesting thing to explore with students. I think it's Karen Armstrong, who was a nun once upon a time of the other spelling, N-U-N.
N-U-N, yeah.
And she very much notices that the rise of fundamentalism in our modern experience and encounter with it, grew up alongside the sciences. As the sciences and modern scholarly disciplines grew through the 19th century, based very much on empirical data, that is verifiable study and facts, which rather put the Bible and some religious claims on the wrong foot, there became a competing religious narrative which was equally secure, or tried to find a similar security. And one part of that was to, for Europeans to rush to the Middle East and start digging up Noah's Ark and try and verify things that way. The reality is that the Bible is very much interested. I'm always anxious when I say the Bible, as if the Bible speaks with one voice. Sure. It is a myriad of voices in dialogue. But one of the things it's doing is constantly reflecting on the meaning of history, the patterns, what is being revealed in history. And so it's always already one step away from just telling the plain tale as it is. And it's much more interested in the lessons we learn, what is revealed, what is experienced and encountered in history, than the materiality of it itself. That's not, however, simply to do a spiritual riff on the physical and material history. It very much is to do with connected to that material history. One of the key issues for Christianity, of course, is the resurrection of Jesus. And if it is, as it indeed is for some Christians, absolutely key that you believe very much in a physical, literal resurrection of the crucified Jesus, then that has to be understood as a literally historical event. So to start questioning the historicity, the historical veracity of other things is therefore a bit of a threat. And so I think that's one of the hooks that makes history meaningful in a literal way, and really emerges as a major problem in the 19th century when history starts to be defined in terms of verifiable data, sources close to the event, because that's not how history had been understood, read or perceived before that. And then when you get to something like how Jesus was buried and the reality of the resurrection, it is lost to us in that historical way.
There's something so unsatisfying about having to accept that we will never get complete answers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I really appreciate the efforts, the scholarship about various historical figures and about what life truly was like and what we can glean from what we do know and what we don't know and how we know it. I find the epistemology very interesting. But do you find in your teaching career, because you've been teaching for how many years now?
12 years coming on to here, nearly. And I was teaching 4 or 5 before that, so 16, 17 years.
Is biblical literacy on the decline?
Probably. I think that people are not raised en masse to recite Bible verses and are told their Bible stories. Now, in England, it wasn't untypical, certainly when I was going to public schools, in the American sense of public schools, from the age of 4 or 5, that we would have a Bible reading and a prayer in the morning. And I know that's not the American way of doing things, but you would get to know many of your Bible stories that way. Church attendance in Britain is pretty darn low. And even among a lot of, well, I noticed one of the things that I had to get used to when I first started teaching formally was the things that I couldn't assume much about biblical knowledge in detail. So one of the exercises I do now, and many a student will immediately shriek with the memory of it, but the first semester, the introduction to the Bible semester, I set 20 chapters of scripture a week to read, and they have to write a 3x5 card on it for every chapter they read. On one side, a summary of the content of the chapter, and on the other side, every question, however pious or otherwise, and I prefer the otherwise, that pops up in their brain as they're reading, to write that down. So by the end of the semester, I've made them read the stories of Abraham. I've made them read the stories of Moses. And for many people, that's quite a revelation, because these characters, when you read them in detail, are not what you thought they were, or not the Sunday school version necessarily.
You at least seem to take a little pleasure in seeing their reactions. You have this nefarious grin.
Yeah, I guess I do.
Why is that?
Because it's the beginning of work. Because I think the Bible is a victim of its own success, in that it gets lifted and lauded and clay and all kinds of claims made for it, which are all often very reductive. And I think that the Bible is far more troubling, less convenient to our modern spiritualities, is what I mean by troubling. Far more troubling, and at the same time, way more interesting than we give it credit for. Abraham is a very ambiguous figure as a father of faith and monotheism. He isn't always a figure that we can admire, and it's interesting to actually sit with that and look at the implications of that. And sometimes that's much more rich and provides a much richer discussion and theological set of theological insights than just to have this plaster saint figure who did whatever God said.
So why do we do hagiography in the realm like this where, well, I guess hagiography is part of the course.
Yeah.
It's a matter of course. But why do we do it when we tell these stories if the actual figures, either historically or in the long tradition of the centuries, is much richer, is much more nuanced?
That's a very good question, which I ponder and don't have an easy answer for. There's an interesting, not entirely successful essay by Susan Sontag from the mid-60s called Against Interpretation. And there she begins with, I think, a fair claim that the authoritative texts of a while back to the most recent generation are always going to be clumsy and problematic. And if they're sacred texts, we then have to deal with that, and we don't like them. So one of the first things we do is allegorize them. And so you certainly see that in when the Bible really was formed and at the heart of rabbinic and early church studies, a lot of the studies were allegorical. So we didn't have to deal with the unpleasant behaviors of the deity or some of the characters. They were all an allegory of something else. So, and we do that in different ways. We do that with our Sunday schools. People become kind of studies in faith or life examples of good faith and niceness. And that, I see the usefulness of that, but then it becomes theologically, religiously facile. And I don't know that we've served our churches or our society very well by doing that. And I think then when people tire of that, they're going to reject the Bible as superficial or nonsensical. And I think then that's something, that's an ancient wisdom that is lost.
If the Bible is a victim of its own success and it gets too reductive, give me an example.
Great, thank you for that. Well, let me stick with Abraham. Well, let me stick with Abraham,
yeah.
Who is seen as the father of faith, a person who stepped away from polytheism to follow unquestioningly the true God, and really sets the story of salvation in motion, would be sort of a common characterization. Well, one of my former professors from Union Theological Seminary in New York City has a wonderful essay on, well, Sarah and Hagar. But she asked the question that when we see Abraham called by God and just going unquestioningly, is this great faith or great passivity? And there are times when his wife Sarah, brings him a problem, and he is seen to just say, whatever you want, do it. And really backing off from engaging. And then we have the whole story of Sarah Abraham and Hagar, the servant girl who is brought into the mix and made to bear children for Abraham. And Hagar is an Egyptian slave. And one of the things the story then becomes is a question of what religious privilege can sometimes be used to license.
Abraham had children with an Egyptian slave?
Yes, Ishmael.
See, this is where the teachings I can recall were certainly scrubbed up a little.
Yeah. Sarah is seen to give her servant girl, her Egyptian servant girl, Hagar, to Abraham when Sarah herself is failing to fall pregnant and have a child. And Abraham and Hagar together produce Ishmael. And then this is now an added problem to Sarah. Rather than fixing Sarah's problem, it becomes an added problem. Nobody comes particularly well out of this story, with the exception of Hagar, who is very much the victim of circumstance and claims her own exodus by running away from the Hebrews home to Egypt, ironically. So even there you hear some real self-critique in the story. So people who have a sense of special blessing and promise from God are seen to be careless and rather entitled with their dealings with others. It becomes a critique of religious privilege, and then read in that context when Abraham finally has a son, Isaac, with Sarah, and God immediately asks Abraham to go and sacrifice this son as a kind of a test. And it's a very elusive and fascinating and difficult and painful story, but you get a sense that maybe this is as much a test about Abraham's sense of right and privilege, and to just say, God gives, God takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Don't presume upon your blessing, particularly if it means you are cruel to others.
Wow. Well, we're talking to Mark Bremen, a professor of Hebrew Bible interpretation at Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School, on this day after Christmas. One of, to me, the really fascinating people in this town. So it's a great privilege to have the professor come in and spend this time with us.
And I wore fancy socks, especially, rather misunderstanding what radio's about, I understand.
Yes. Well, you don't have radio in England.
We have the wireless. A big wooden box, and we all sit round and speak in very clipped tones.
Yes. You hunt and gather there still, yeah?
Sure.
Okay. Professor Brummett spending the hour with us. Let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to continue on the thread of those note cards, because I do want to know the reaction he sees from some of his students, because he clearly takes a little glee in seeing their own understanding of stories go from these hagiographic ideals to something much more textured and rich. What happens when we understand the Bible, when we understand teaching this way, and we understand our world this way? And we're going to talk a little bit more about the nuns, the rise of the nuns, if he sees any problem with that, if he sees any problem with a society that's becoming less biblically literate. And then finally, we're going to ask him what he thinks about a fellow Brit, Andrew Sullivan, who recently wrote that he thinks even atheists are religious, that all human beings need religion of some sort in their life to worship something unquestionably. We'll see what Professor Bremen has to say about that. It's our only break, and we're right back on Connections. Before we get back to the program, a little reminder. Every Friday afternoon, WXXI drops a brand new podcast from producer Megan Mack and me. We call it Weekend Connections, the podcast. It's clever, isn't it? It's kind of a summary of the week on the talk show, the highlight moments, the parts of conversation that made us laugh or cry or think deeply about a wide range of issues. We produce more than 500 hours of this talk show every year. You can't possibly hear them all, and I know we've got a lot of people who listen quite religiously, to borrow a phrase, but we know you can't listen to them all. So every Friday afternoon, please head to wherever you get your podcasts and join us for Weekend Connections. 20 minutes or less, perfect for the treadmill or with your morning coffee. Thank you. Welcome back to Connections. My guest, Professor Mark Bremen, professor of Hebrew Bible interpretation at Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School, a man with an obnoxious resume that even includes an ethics prize back in like 1996.
Well, the year I was given that ethics prize, I didn't know it was coming, and I was sitting in the student lounge slightly drunk with a cigarette hanging out of my mouth, and they called me out to collect this prize, and I was, I looked anything but ethical.
Why did you win a prize for ethics?
Why?
Yeah, what?
I was doing a class, and I think I just got the best results in the class or something.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It looks much grander on you.
Yeah, no, I can't remember. It's a while ago. It was something like that of out of that year I got the best mark or something.
You're either being entirely humble or your resume with the G.F. Woods Prize for Ethics should be investigated.
Well, go investigate it.
Yes, exactly.
Because I did get it, but I didn't get it under glorious extra work.
That's
or
the
anything,
point. It really looks glorious. It really looks glorious. So, Professor, you were mentioning that you ask students to write on note cards their thoughts, their questions, pious or impious, and you know, you had this kind of this grin on your face that indicated you really take some pleasure in seeing the reaction. So what's some of the response you get with that?
There's a reaction that it's a lot of work. And I think it must be. And every week you're reading another 15 to 20 chapters of the Bible and having to fill in a form with it, fill in a card. And a lot of people are grateful by the end of the semester because they've tackled the Bible in a way that they've never done before and they have a much stronger sense of it. But I think it's troubling that sometimes you read stories and they are not comfortable or nice. They are full of figures who we thought were going to be noble spirits come across as sometimes petty and angry, and that includes the deity. So, but it is a starting point of any subsequent work.
Boy, the Old Testament God was this really recalcitrant, insecure. I could go on. That's my interpretation.
Uh-huh.
No?
The emphasis in the Old Testament Hebrew Bible is on a collective national history, not over centuries. So you're going to have to involve warfare and defeat and victory in there, and you don't want to take the deity out of it. Also, we have this thing... Christianity grew in a very Greek setting, full of Greek philosophy, with the idea of a deity being very much beyond. And yet the idea of God in the Bible is relational. And the only way we really get to express that is inevitably anthropomorphized. And so we have a God who is disappointed and angry and passionate and jealous and loving. And that is sometimes a problematic depiction to work with. But what it is expressing, if I may just develop that briefly, but you have two pole ideas, two ends of the spectrum. One is that a God is in some way, by being God, beyond and free and uniquely free. And there's a danger there that a God who is by definition uniquely free can tire, can walk off, is related to us, unhindered or hobbled by us. And at the other end of the spectrum is a God who is defined by our idea of justice. So this is the God who answers prayer and who punishes wickedness. And if you think about it, that God is little more than a vending machine. I put in good things and God will bless, and I put in bad stuff and God will punish. And apart from that, not quite playing out in history so obviously, it is still it's a God where we end up calling the shots. So God is either that constrained or that free. Either is terrifying because it's not much of a God. So what in biblical thinking, it expresses some midpoint where God is engaged in justice, but chooses to step out of, or chooses to self-limit freedom to be engaged. And it's, what is the mediating point between those? It's relation. It's being related to the course of human history, and that then becomes, how do we know, as I say, relation? Through passion, through anger, through love, through weeping, through all the things which then, when we write up big on the heavens, are uncomfortable to us. But that is the beginning point of theological reflection.
Well, and the long game, I suppose, in this conversation about that started with the question of the rise of the religious unaffiliated or the nuns or the secularists in modern times is to say that as you have taught, maybe you notice a little bit less biblical literacy, but that is not just among secularists. I do not typically find many Christian friends who are all that biblically literate, and I find that very curious.
Yeah. And
is that fair or unfair?
No, I think it sounds fair, but I don't know if I'm well equipped to explain it. I'm sure there are people who actually study that and can give you all kinds of
I'm not going to look
charts and things. But
I'm not going to grill you for explanation.
No, but I do. So, and I recognize that my story is a little unusual, but I wasn't brought up in a church family. My parents were Methodist by identity, but I don't remember them ever. I remember once being taken to a Methodist church, but it was not part of our habit and routine. And I was a slightly odd one in the family, and having a strange interest in things godly from an early age. And I, as an early teenager, took myself off to church. Just walked there one Sunday morning and started going. And I went to a Baptist church in my hometown, and I went to the Sunday school, and they gave me a paperback Bible. And because they'd given me this, and I was rather excited by it, I went home and read it, like all of it. It took me a year, and then I kept doing so. And it wasn't, I didn't really realize that wasn't usual. But then I became finally affiliated with a particular evangelical church for a number of years, where there really was an emphasis on biblical knowledge and literacy, and where there were a lot of time spent in reading the Bible. So I was fostered in a world, and this is a peculiar habit of my own, was to be fairly biblically literate. And so I'm always a little surprised when people from a much more churched background than I had are a lot less so, and I don't know what I can say about that.
Well,
other than I punish them for it with these cards.
Now, the reason I ask is, I guess I was mildly interested if that annoys you, given your profession, but I'm more interested what you think of writers like Sam Harris, who will say that when people who are religious or self-described as religious actually read their holy texts, they become less religious. Do you think that that's right?
Well, I'm not sure what even religious means in that context. It's such a, what is he trying to express happens?
I think he's expressing that when people actually read holy books, they find so much dissonance that they no longer believe that the large creation stories.
I don't think that bears out in reality. Well, obviously it doesn't. And I think it's, again, to do with how we're encouraged to read. And clearly my little card exercise is encouraging people to read critically and ask the unaskable. And some of them get alarmingly good at it. And yet they don't then simply jettison it. And I don't know why that is either. I don't know why I don't, other than that it pays my bills not to. But I, in the last few years, have returned to a pulpit ministry and preach about once a month in the general year and thoroughly enjoy that. But what I find is what I can do in the pulpit is actually sometimes, if it's a difficult text, start with that and say, this is awful. I did that 2 weeks ago at a church in Canandaigua and said, I didn't know why I was given this week to preach. And then I noticed the text is awful.
And you said so?
Yes. So let's get going with it. And
Does that get some uncomfortable laughs from the
congregation?
Well,
you've got to choose your audience, and I had already a relationship, bit of a relationship with this audience, and I knew that that would work. And let's be honest, you put anything in an English accent, and it gives it a...
Americans think any British accent is super compelling, intelligent. You get so much more credit right out of the gate.
Precisely. So I have that working for me, And also, it's a nice way of making people suddenly listen, my goodness, what's he going to do? And then if you actually do something which is not unhelpfully skeptical or cynical even, but actually makes something difficult meaningful, and you wonder why it's there, you start to think, well, yeah, I don't like that, but now I get a sense of why it's there and why it offers us something, then... Well, that's okay, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I would think that a congregation, I would want to believe that a congregation would appreciate that as opposed to sort of buffing off the rough edges of it.
Yeah, and I find that that does happen. I do a weekly Bible education program in Pittsford. You know, it's... I must sound appalling, mustn't I, doing these things? Your basic nightmare.
No, you have a fun side.
I do have a fun side, but I have to be careful when people ask me what I do in a bar. I have to be careful how I answer, or I'll never get sex, would I? But so I do this Bible study in Pittsford, and when I started there, I was getting reasonable numbers, but now I get a ridiculous number of people who come, and I do think it's to do with the fact that I just go for it. I don't patronize people with... nice, tidy thoughts, but I bring them what's going on in scholarship right now, and they're genuinely interested, and they're probably genuinely regularly listening to this show as well.
Well, is there a cost to a society that has a declining level of biblical literacy?
Probably not.
No?
No.
You think there's no cost to a society that...
Well, any more than there is to... not hugely.
See, now the secularists are cheering you.
Well, yeah, good for them. Because when I arrived here, in one of some event I was at, somebody said, oh, I hear about how the rise of secularism in Britain. It must be really troubling to you. And I was thinking, oh, I thought it was quite a good thing that there isn't this kind of social obligation to go to church. I don't know that that's ever served Christianity particularly well. I've never really felt like that because my own family and most of my best friends don't give two hoots about it. And so I've recognized that I'm the odd bod. I don't know. I think there's something a little bit self-congratulatory about a lot of religious practice, and I don't go with that. I think it's very rich. I would love more people to understand and have an appreciation of the richness rather than dismiss it, but I don't know that I wonder if that comes by a genuine interest rather than a cultural expectation, mm-hmm. and I don't know that you can sort of manage it apart.
Any sort of obligation, I mean, whether it's family or societal obligation or your own sense of obligation because you're making Pascal's wager, which I never understood, this notion that God would say, well, look, you didn't really believe, but you did go to church, and you might have been a real cad 7 days a week. But for that hour, you were there telling me how great I was. How insecure is God? We still have the Old Testament God hanging around?
Yeah. Well, that's a very New Testament idea as well. I don't like to separate the testaments out quite.
See, I am not the scholar here.
There are different nuances, but there's plenty of that going on. But at the same time, it's also, I don't think it's a very... it's not a particularly reasonable representation of all that's going on in biblical representations of it. There is always this sense that God is willing salvation, whatever that means, and that there is a get on board with it or not. It's always a question among the great theologians through history of the reality of the God who punishes, or with it, there is going to be one day when all will be saved, but there's a recognition that it's, you don't earn brownie points, you don't earn medals from God, and depending on how many you've collected over your life gets you into heaven or not, whether that's by doing good things or doing church, because the reality is that God is already there on your side prior to that. God is not the parent who merits you or otherwise. Or the parent's not necessarily a good image of a sort of school teacher who grades you in that way. There is this sense that that there's an asymmetry here, that we could be pretty awful and yet there is a goodness waiting for us, seeing and soliciting the goodness, and that that works somewhat differently from that merit system. I don't know if I'm articulating that at all well.
I think you are.
But it undermines our pretensions somewhat.
Yeah, we're ascribing this human idea to a deity, that everything is just a reward.
Yeah.
That you've got to.
Which goes to that kind of mechanical God thing,
yeah,
and it's more relational than that already. Yeah. So
let me wrap the hour with the question on the recent piece in New York Magazine that we had a conversation on the program about not too long ago with a panel of atheists responding to Andrew Sullivan, a British conservative writer who said that, among other things, even atheists are religious, and by religious he means all human beings have a need for meaning. And we pursue that in various ways, but one of the ways is really creating a belief system that is independent of the need for evidence. Mm-hmm. And he said that he sees that in Donald Trump's supporters who worship him almost as a deity and truly agree with him when he says he could go on Fifth Avenue, shoot somebody, and they'd still vote for him. He ascribes that to the social justice movement, which he is very critical of. And he says atheists, yes, they believe so strongly that there is no God, that equals the belief of those who do believe there's a God, which I think he is far afield there and out of his depth on understanding atheism. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you if you agree with him that human beings have a need for some sort of religious construction of one kind or another.
I think there is a... Again, sort of huge generalizations like this are only meaningful in a limited way, but I think there is a general human sense of awe that is fairly present universally, if I can say anything is present universally, and different, it emerges differently in different cultures and societies, but we all know that sense of awe, whether it's to a piece of music or simply looking at the night sky or to somebody who is a clearly self-defined atheist looking at a math problem and being fascinated and having a sense of awe at physics or evolution or something like that. And so maybe that's the kind of impulse behind what Andrew Sullivan here is articulating. Whether that amounts to a belief, going back to what we said at the beginning about the lack of final verification, I think that that's where I would hover in this, that the awe expresses something and then we explain that and we give it a grammar and a structure, and but it can only be provisional.
Thanks for coming in today.
A very great pleasure.
It's the day after Christmas. Can I wish you a happy Christmas?
You certainly can.
Well,
I had a wonderful one. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And to all of our audience who celebrates, Merry Christmas to you And I'm really always glad to have these conversations and to grateful to an audience that appreciates them. Mark Brummett is a professor of Hebrew Bible interpretation at Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School. Let's chat again soon. In fact, we will. You'll hear from Mark on New Year's Eve in our Rochester's Favorite Book Show. And I'm eager for our listeners to hear that conversation because it goes to how he brings together his teachings, biblical literacy, and Frankenstein. So we'll talk to you on New Year's Eve.
Thank you very much. See you then.
The engineer of Connections is Rob Braden. The producer is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.